Last week we had the introduction to King David, the author who we assigned to this book. And now we have our grand opening. We start chapter 1 of the Psalms. It's so exciting. On the edge of our chairs. So I've split up the printing so that you have the text of the Tehillim separate to the commentary we're going to go through. So that as we turn pages, you'll still have the chapter you can put next to it. And that's how I'd have it for you. Put one next to the other. Okay. So our first task, naturally, is going to be reading the chapter itself. We're going to go through the verses with a little bit of explanation, and then as we have completed that, we'll turn back to a little bit of insight to dig a little deeper, like King David, the King of Spades, into the work to try and understand it. So, I've split the verses into three groups on the page of the text. And we're going to read them with a different thing in mind for each group. The first group, as we read it, we have to think about the three figures. You don't have to know what that is yet. But as we're reading, think about the three figures who appear in those first two verses. And then when we read the second group, we're going to think about the metaphor in those verses. And then in the third group, we're going to focus on the last verse, the meaning of that last verse. So that's what we're going to have in mind while we're reading. And let's begin. Verse 1. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzat rasha'im. Happy is the person who does not walk in the wicked's counsel. And before we even go any further, Nachum Sarna, the man I mentioned last week, who did pass away in 2005, so I did apologize to his family, a wonderful scholar, noted something in his commentary that struck a chord. Just listen to that sound as we start. Ashrei Ha'ish Asher. There is an alliteration, an assonance, and he calls this conscious artistry, the way King David starts. And we can take it even a step further. It's not just an alliteration which calls our attention, it's a particular sound. Ashrei. Ha'ish Ash. What sound does that remind you of? Shh. And in case you think I'm being a little silly, which I may be, there is a book by Fredrik Lindstrom, who was a Norwegian academic, and in his book called The World's Smartest Word, he speaks at length about the word shh, and he points out, or he submits, it is the only, the single word that is common to every human language. And if you look at larger words for quiet, hush, shush, and in German there are words, in Scottish, which apparently has its own language, there are words, the Welsh of sh all over the place, sh exists across human language as a quieting gesture. So as we begin the Psalms, as we're opened into David's world, he begins with that assonance, a call to silence, a call to attention. What we have to say is important. Ashrei. Ashrei ha'ish ashehullah. Happy is the person who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, and does not stand in the company of the sinner, of a moshav late simlo yashav, and does not sit with the scoffers. Verse 1. So happy is the man who doesn't sit with the wicked, who doesn't walk with the wicked, stand with the sinner, or sit with the scoffer. Verse 2. Why? Ki im b'torat Hashem chevtso, because his desire is the word of God. V'torato yehegeh yomam v'layla, and in his law, in God's Torah, he will murmur, he will study all day and all night. That's the first group. We were thinking about those three figures. The wicked one, the sinner, and the scoffer. We'll come back to that. Next group. Here we think about the metaphor. And now we're describing this person who is ashrei, who is happy, who avoids wickedness. What is he like? Vahayaka eitz shatul al palge mayim. He's like a tree planted by streams of water. Asher piryo yiten beito, which bears fruit in its proper season. Va'aleu lo yibol. Evergreen, its leaves never wither. V'chol asher ya'aseh, and all that it does, yatzliach, it prospers. Lo chein harasha'im, but not so for the wicked, that character again. What is the wicked like? Ki'im kamotz, like chaff, asher tidfenu ruach, scattered by the wind. That's group two, thinking about the metaphor of trees and chaff. And now, the third group. Al kein, therefore, come to a thesis and a conclusion in this chapter. Lo yakumu rasha'im ba'mishpat, the wicked will not stand in judgment. V'chata'im ba'adat tzadikim, and the sinner will not stand in the adat, in the congregation of tzadikim. And we can parallel maybe at the beginning, we said he shouldn't walk in the atzat rasha'im, in the council of the wicked, and there's a poetic resemblance here. Adat tzadikim. You have an adat versus atzat, which grammatically, I'm not an expert, but grammatically a dalad is a softer vowel than a tzadi. Adat, there's less tongue involved, less licentious, less bitter talk. The tzadikim stand in congregations, not in their tangled jungles of council, forests like atzat, which have also is a foreshadowing of the tree metaphor to come. So now that we've made this all complicated, wonderful. Okay. Al kein lo yakumu rasha'im b'mishpat, the wicked will not stand in judgment, v'chata'im ba'adat tzadikim, neither will the sinners stand among the righteous. And this verse, we're going to understand at the very end, the following verse. Ki yodea Hashem derech tzadikim, because God knows the path of the righteous. He knows it. Wonderful. God knows a few things. Why is that relevant? We'll talk about that. V'derech v'sha'im toved, and the path of the wicked will perish. Also a strong statement, also something we have to talk about, which is a much larger philosophical question, do the wicked prosper? The book of Job is dedicated to a question like that, perhaps. So that's something we're going to have to talk about. A conclusion, the wicked will not prosper, the righteous will be known by God. So we've now seen the chapter, we've seen the verses, we can dive in. So this is the point at which I would separate your sheets and have the chapter on one side. And now we're going to turn the page to page 3 and have a little look at some commentary. So, Ashrei Ha'ish, happy is the person. Yeah.
In most of the Rosh Hashanah, where it says Ashrei Ha'ish, the Mishnah says a similar warning. Is that also from God and Mel?
I wish I could remember. It's likely it's from Tehillim, but I can't remember. I'll have to look it up in the Koran. It's got a little notation next to it. But excellent point. It has a similar ring to it and the same resonance. Okay, so let's dive into the concept here. Ashrei Ha'ish, happy is the person. Why is that the opening contained by the hushing introduction to David's thought? Why is happiness important? So, we begin with a gentle introduction. Let's have a look at the Midrash, page 3 at the top. This is David speaking. Ma bori lo hotzi dava mugunah mipiv. David reasons with himself. Just as God doesn't speak in insulting ways, he speaks pleasantness. Af David, also David, me, kach, I will do the same. And then the Midrash elucidates. Hayalola Meima, he could have begun Psalms with the following words. Arur ha'ish asher halach ba'atzat rasha'im. Cursed be the person who walks with evil. But he doesn't say that. Below Amar ela ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzat rasha'im. He says, happy is the person who avoids evil. So he elaborates, he adds more words to build a constructive statement. And in some ways, reflecting his own advice, he doesn't go with the counsel of the wicked. He doesn't insult and throw out aggressive terms. Cursed be you. He begins with an example of his message. Happy is the person who is not like that. Let's talk positive. Let's be constructive. So that's the opening. Who's here read the picture of Dorian Gray? Who's heard of the picture of Dorian Gray? Wonderful. Written by Oscar Wilde, an Englishman. In some sense. And the picture of Dorian Gray is not a large book. It can be somewhat dense, but it's a wonderful work which speaks about a young man. Youthful, intelligent, innocent, and key, handsome. Oscar Wilde talks about Dorian Gray, this young boy who's being painted in a portrait by his friend. And Lord Henry Wotton walks onto the scene. Lord Henry, figure of authority, he's a lord. He turns and he sees this young child. He says, ah, Dorian, he's going to be my project. I'm going to teach him. I'm going to mentor him into the ways of being a man. And he then corrupts this young boy. Dorian Gray, whose perfect image is captured in this painting, has to make a deal with the devil. because Lord Henry takes him on a foray into lust and deceit and depravity. And Dorian makes a deal with the devil that he will stay ever youthful and the painting will age in the attic. And then, I won't spoil the end for you, something happens at the end and everything explodes. You can read it. And this whole book is about the chasing of meaning, of finding something. Is it happiness? What is Lord Henry advertising? And at this point, we're going to read that small quote. One of Dorian's friends turns to him and says, "Does his philosophy make you happy? This Lord Henry who makes you chase depravity, go into brothels, run around cheating and betraying, does that make you happy?" And then, trained by Lord Henry in the ways of wit, he responds, "I have never searched for happiness. Who wants happiness? I have searched for pleasure." A fine distinction, but an important one. And Nachum Sarna, who we'll turn to again, makes that distinction in our opening verse. Ashrei ha'ish. It is happiness, to be noted, not pleasure, that concerns the psalmist. Pleasure may be self-centered, a transient, agreeable sensation or emotion, an instinctive response to a particular stimulus that gratifies the senses. A rather long sentence. And it may be frivolous and illusory. By contrast, happiness is deep-rooted. Metaphor with roots, we'll get to later. It penetrates the very depths of one's being, and it is serious and enduring. In fact, it is this last quality, enduring, which most distinguishes it from pleasure. Pleasure is transient, happiness is enduring. And to really make the point, I thought, where else could we turn but Mr. Happy? I don't know if it's an American book, but as a child I read the Mr. Men series. It has a United States website, so either they're trying to make money or they do read it here. Just look at that face. That's not pleasure. That's happiness. That is sublime bliss. That is contentment. His whole being smiles. Even his eyes are smiles. His hands are behind his back. There is nothing he wants to grab or reach. He's content. His equal feet. He's balanced. Who says you can't interpret cartoons? Okay. So that's what we're focused on. Ashrei. We're not focused on pleasure, ta'anug. We're not focused on hana'a. We're talking about ashrei, happiness. And now to further the point, give it a slightly deeper layer, we turn to the malbim. This is the bottom box on page 3. Ba'ala va'er. What is the purpose of this chapter? It comes to explain hatana'im sha'avuram yeha ish ma'ushar. The conditions under which a person is happy. Okay, we got that. V'yesh havdel ben ma'ushar uvein matzliach. And there is a difference between happiness and success. A very similar distinction the Malbin makes a couple of generations before Nachum Sarna, which others have done before him. Ha'atzachahu be'inyanim olamiyim. Because success or pleasure is in earthly matters. But happiness is a spiritual state. And now he makes this point through the language, which is the deeper layer that we're looking to. He could have begun, Ashrei mi shelo halach ba'atzat rashim. Happy is they who does not do this. But he says, Ashrei ha'ish. What makes us humane? What speaks beyond our animate life, but touches on our humanity. That is the concern of this chapter. A happiness of ish, which could be gendered to mean male, but it means person in this sense. Okay, page 1, straightforward. We want to be happy. We don't want to be depraved like Lord Henry makes Dorian. We want to be happy. Ashrei. So we turn the page now to page 4. And we're now going to focus on those three figures with one more caveat to the word Ashrei. And for this caveat, we turn to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who we had last week. Top box, page 4. Afal pisha hashoresh Ashrei karov lashoresh osher. Even though the root of the Hebrew word Ashrei, to be happy, is close to the word osher, which means wealthy or riches. Ezehu Hashir, who is rich. It's very similar. Hamorim al tzfirat kochot unsachim, which speaks about gathering and accumulating substance. To be wealthy, you draw in. You are the center point of gravity. And it's similar, it seems. Happiness involves accumulation. But then he says, Hine me'idach, but alternatively there is a different ramification to this root. Mitzviyat hamilim ashur. It's linked to the word ashur, which means step, like a staircase, have ashurim. Sa'ad, which also means step, hitzgadmut, progress. Ashrei mesamenet, therefore the word ashrei indicates kol hitkamut afshariot, all possible advance. Because this happiness, this contentment, isn't exactly like Mr. Happy. We're not standing, hands behind our back on our feet, just smiling. This is a happiness that isn't passive, it involves progress, taking strides, setting aspirations. It is ashrei, a happiness that is made through ashurim, through making steps. What steps do we have to make? We have to confront these three figures, who we're now going to define. One at a time. First, Rav Shimshon Fol Hirsch is going to help us define the Russia. What is Russia? Wicked. We throw it around all the time. Oh, they're a Russia. Hopefully we don't. This one's a Russia. Haman's a Russia. What is a Russia? So, again, through etymology, through roots, Rav Shimshon Fol Hirsch elaborates. Russia, second box, page 4. Karov b'mivato l'Russia. In its expression, it is very similar to the word Russia. For those of you listening, you won't know what I'm making a difference about. But on paper, it has a hey at the end, not an ayin. And what is it linked to? Mimenu habitui ha-talmudi, like the Talmudic notion of rushut. What does rushut mean? There are two meanings, so you might get it. Permission. It means permission. So a Russia is somebody who is permissive, who has no bounds or limits. It's somebody who's happy to do anything, which he then explains. Haratzon halbilti mu'ukav, the untrammeled will. That is the Russia. A person who sees humankind without obligation, duty, responsibility. Society of individuals who just live by rashut, who are permissive. That's the Russia. Figure 1. Figure 2, we turn to the Malbim. What is a choter then? A sinner. How is a sinner different to a Russia? So, again with the verses next to us, we said, uvederech chataim, not atzat chataim, not the counsel of the sinner, but just the path of the sinner. So, he explains again the Malbim. Eitzal chataim lo yachol la'amar ba'atzat. It couldn't possibly have said the counsel of the sinner. David couldn't have said, avoid the sinner's counsel, because the choter, the sinner, doesn't have a philosophy on life. He doesn't live permissively like the Russia. He doesn't sit down in crowds and say, all of you, there is no God. There is no need. I hope they don't take this out of context. There is no need to do duty or obligation. We live in a world of permission. That's not the choter. That's the Russia. The choter is something else. Kihem enam choterim beitzar. They don't do it by will, with counsel. Umosif, and we add, sha'af bederech ha'taim lo amad. And David focuses not just don't walk with them, but don't even stand. Lo amad with a choter. Don't spend a moment, an instant on his path. Why? Shachata im heim choterim mitzat hata'ava levad. Because the choter is ruled by desire, by impulse, by instinct. He's not a philosopher. He can't control his lust. So David's telling us, don't go with these permissive, wicked people who live by philosophy, and don't even spend a second with these impulsive people. Much better you should stand with the wicked, because at least you can argue. But impulse, like that flicker of evil we spoke about last week, who can argue with that? So we've seen the Rasha, we'll stop there. We've seen the Chote, somebody who was ruled by impulse. We'll turn to Oscar Wilde once more just for a quote. What did Lord Henry say to Dorian? It's a quote that stuck in my mind when I read it, so that's why I remembered it. He says to Dorian, the only way to rid yourself of a temptation is to yield to it. A powerful statement which Dorian bought into. And the Chote is somebody who turns this deceitful mantra into a way of life. That I can't help myself. I've got temptation, I can't stop it. The only way to stop it, I'm doing good. I'm ridding myself of temptation. And they convince themselves, that's a choter. The Russia has a philosophy, he's not even admitting an apologetic. So we're still on page 4, we've seen the Russia, we've seen the choter. We're now going to see who is the leitz, who we said, Moshav leitzim lo yashav, don't even sit with these people. Don't sit down with the leitzim. What's a leitz? scoffer, lazy. We all have words for it. Clown, exactly. Makes jokes. So Rav Hirsch, again, through the key of etymology, will have different themes coming up over the course. He understands Leitz in a different way. He looks where it appears through Tanakh. And this is in English. Leitz. In its noble sense, this word denotes the art of translation from one language to another. And this we see with Yosef in Bereshit, when he has to deceive his brothers, mask himself and pretend he's not related. He has a melitz, an interpreter, a translator. No negative connotation, just a translator. That is a melitz. So that's its noble sense. And this sense, when applied to judgment, indicates the proper representation of facts on behalf of the defense. We all have a notion of defense lawyers. We have attorneys. In England, we call them barristers. You call them whatever you like. And Chazal call the angelic defense lawyer the melitz yosher, the upright representer. So melitz isn't a bad thing, right? He represents our defense. He translates evidence into a case. So for Rav Shimshon Afol Hirsch, the root of late is to translate either language, facts, into evidence, into a case. When applied to the emotions, Rav Hirsch says, it denotes pleasant arts, poetry. I'm not sure where he got that from, but there's somewhere where he's going to quote that too, that it converts our aesthetic wishes into reality. But now he turns to our context. In its less noble meaning, however, the word denotes that pernicious and despicable art of distorting speech, translating in a twisted, malicious way. This is the execrable art, which means terrible art, I looked that up, of spurious dialectics and wicked irony. Leitz him, out of habit or from sheer cowardice, still practice all of the Torah, yet ridicule this way of life. They don't have the guts to stand up like the Russia. We're praising the Russia here. At least have a philosophy. Don't sit there hedging your bets, coming to shul, shaking the lulav, putting on your tefillin, eating matzah, and then just making fun. This is stupid. This is ridiculous. That's the late. Somebody who doesn't have the guts to have a philosophy, but just twists, manipulates that execrable art, which Rav Shimshon Afol Hirsch refers to. Okay, so those are our three characters. We've got the Russia, who has the philosophy. We've got the Choter, who has impulse. And we have the Leitz, who is the murky cynic, the translator, who everything has some sort of conspiracy theory. Oh, the rabbis made this up. Oh, that doesn't matter. Mocking. That's the Leitz. So that's what we mean when we say scoffer or clown or lazy. That's the Leitz. Okay, so let's stand back for one moment. Time is marching on, so we're going to ask one more question. Designing this chapter, you want to build up energy. This is the first sentence of Tehillim. You want your readership to be grabbed, to be like building, building. But what does he do? He says, don't walk, don't stand, don't sit. As a reader, you can just feel the energy sapping, right? Why would you write a sentence? Why would you structure it that way? To say, that's great, to say don't walk, don't be energized, don't even stand still, don't come to immobility, and don't even relax, don't sit. As a reader, you drop off. But if we're reading it not as what are we being told not to do, but what are we being told to do, we're being told to resist those things. And the energy read like that builds. Because to not walk doesn't take much. I can just walk in a different direction. I'm standing here. I won't turn to the right. I'll turn to the left. To not stand takes a little more because you have to keep walking. And to not sit, you have to really fight gravity, fight the impulse for leisure. So if we read it as the power of resistance, then even this structure builds in energy and it changes our perspective because we're looking at the inside. Resistance is an internal feeling. And this Tehillim makes us look inward. That is the energy that builds. So when we pick up Tehillim, we're grasped by the ush. Then, wow, I can't turn a different way. I can't stand. I can't sit. I've got a lot of internal energy. Okay, that's page 4. We now turn to page 5. And for this, we have to take a little step backward. So we focused on the metaphor in these verses, the metaphor of the tree and of the chaff. So, to help us understand this, we turn to the Norse peoples. Who are the Norse peoples? Excuse my slight lisp. Not the North, but the North.
Vikings,
Scandinavians, Europeans. These were the clans that lived on the fringes of forests, deepened by legend, thickened by myth. They had all the stories of Thor, which came out as a movie a couple of years ago, guy with a big hammer, great at DIY. Those are the Norse peoples, which I've now made fun of, so I apologize to the Norse peoples. They're not going to get angry, they're no longer here. I apologize if they are. And at the core of their myth, of their law, is something called the Yggdrasil. Something you may not have heard of, something I hadn't heard of either, which is a huge tree. It is a massive tree which roots go down to hell, branches reach up to heaven, and it connects everything in between. And at the center of their thought is this massive tree which interconnects the world. And we understand that this worship existed. In the Torah we have the Asherah. And we often think, what a bunch of fools. They're worshipping a tree in the garden? I planted that myself. But if we start, again, not to encourage this behavior, but if we think about what it represents, the roots that hold tight to the earth, the branches that have aspirations of reaching up, we can see embedded in that picture a permanent, say, universality. There's a real temptation that you could see these people having. So that tree, which is in our metaphor, as the tzaddik, as the righteous, or the ashrei, the happy, exists in other faiths, or other religions, or races. In fact, turning to this continent, I did my little European bit, because that's where I'm from. If you turn to Native Americans, there is, in one of the tribes, they have a notion of creation very different from our own. Their creation was a tree existed. It grew and split into two, and that was the first man and woman. That was creation. So something in our being, in their imagination, something in our essence is tree-like. We're rooted, we have aspiration. One can see that happening. So again, David's metaphor of the happy person as a tree maybe has some echoes or resemblance to these ideas. But before we let that settle in, we have a very different creation history. We don't think man and woman came from trees. Where did they come from?
Dirt.
Yes. Dirt, dust, the earth. And Rashi explains where this dust came from. Because we are Jews, we want to know the details. We don't want to just be dust, any old dust that was on top of a cabinet. Where did this dust come from? Rashi tells us. Afar min ha'adama, dust of the earth. Which dust? Tiber afaro mikol adama mi arba ruchot. God gathered and assembled dust from all four corners of the earth. We like dust from everywhere. We're well travelled. We're not from some back corner. Then he explains why. Shekol makom shiamot sham, because wherever the human being dies, tehei kol tato likvura, the ground should be able to reabsorb. We never want to be foreign in death. Wherever we die, that's where we belong. And Rav Soloveitchik has a wonderful explanation of this in the next box. Man was created of cosmic dust. God gathered dust of which man was fashioned from all parts of the earth. Indeed, from all the uncharted lanes of creation, man belongs everywhere. And this notion, our creation, we're not like trees. We're not stick in the muds. We are adventurers and explorers. We are global people, which has aspiration to chase and travel, but also the obligation to seek out oppression, injustice, cruelty, anywhere, whether it's in our back garden, on our home turf, or on the other side of the earth. We are conscious of the world. We are made of cosmic dust. We're not local creatures. Yeah.
Where it says, Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, is that referring to a rooted aspect as well?
That's an excellent point. Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh appears in Shoftim in Dvarim. And there are two readings. One reading is saying, is a tree really like a man? You can't cut down a tree. It's not like a man. It can't run away. It's different. Which would make our point. But Chazal reread it as Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, man is like a tree. So we have that tension even in that verse, which we're going to turn to in a moment. Because we do have some tree light. After all, David's verses, we read, he compares the happy to a tree. We're going to have to face that tension. And you've brought us there, so we will. Look at the box below that tree by the water. Adam sheyesh bo ma'asim tovim, a person who has good deeds, v'lama Torah harbeh, and is well learned. L'mahu domeh, what are they like? What can we compare them to? L'ilan she'omed al hamayim, to a tree, not just any tree, but omed al hamayim, by the water. Anafav mu'atim, its branches are few, v'sharashav mu'rubim, and its roots are deep. Why? Afilu arba ruchot haolam ba'ot, even if the four winds gather against them, ein mezizot otomim kamo, it shall not move. Shneamar, now this wonderful expedition of human righteousness, where's the source? Our song. It says, v'haya ke'etz shatul al palgemayim, this happy person, this righteous person, is like a tree, shatul, planted, al palgemayim, by the waters. So what happened to our cosmic dust? What happened to Avraham of this week's parasha? Lech lecha, go, be in motion. What happened to that nature of ours that isn't local, that isn't rooted, that isn't stuck in the mud? Why is David and Chazal following him, praising the tree-like? And in Avodah Zarah, Chazal answer our question, bringing up that tension, or reflecting the tension we mentioned a moment ago. And look at this box, second up, page 5. Amre debe Reb Yanai, they said in the house of Reb Yanai. Ke'etz shatul, let's be specific here, let's not be quick readers, but slow readers. Etz shatul, velo ke'etz natua, we say like a planted tree. Eitz shatul veloka eitz natua, and not like a natua tree. Now, what is the difference between shatul and natua? We've got this grammatic difference, but how do we deal with it? Rashi explains. Shatul. What is shatul? Exactly. Ne'ekar mikan, uprooted here, v'chazar v'nishtal b'makom acher, and replanted elsewhere. So conscious of that need not to be local, to be permanently rooted, unable to adapt, David uses the word shatul. Not planted, but transplanted. Or transplanted, in the way I would say it. I'm losing my accent. My family who listened to the recording pointed that out. So we're now dealing with that tension, that we are not rooted like the Native Americans would have it, that our creation, our essence is tree-like. We don't value trees like the Asherah, like the Yggdrasil at the center of our world. We are made of cosmic dust, inbuilt with lech lecha, the need to chase, to be in motion, but never to be as chaff, kamotz, tidfenu ruach, wandering, drifting, aimlessly, caught in gusts of impulse like the chote. We are always rooted, but equally adaptable. We can uproot and find the closest river, chase the tributaries to that water, so we are always charged, always alive. The next box is a side point, so I'm deciding whether to say it or not, but we'll say it because it comes from our psalm, why not? And we've got probably the time to do it. Bottom box on page 5, and this is for all those cynics in here or out there who thinks poetry is a waste of time, who thinks, what are we doing Tehillim for? Tell me what bracha I should say. Tell me how many leaves my lulav should have. Tell me what color my tefillin should be. Probably none of you are going to ask that. But if you did, I'd have to answer. So, why am I not giving you concrete law? We are a religion of legal ritual. What are you standing here, philosophizing, waxing poetry? So, Amar Rav Acha Bar Ada, Amar Rav Hamnuna, Amar Rav. A whole bunch of rabbis say the following thing. In the name of Rav. Minayin sha'afilu sichat talmidei chachamim sricha limud. How do I know that even the musings, the mere conversation, the sicha of scholars requires, deserves, and demands study? Why should I study that? And their answer, Shnei Amar, there is a verse. We're not making it up. We have a proof text. What does it say? Va'aleu lo yibol. Its leaves will not wither. What does that mean? Rashi elucidates, which I didn't put on, I apologize. What is aleu? What are the leaves on a tree? If you think about the structure, the anatomy of a tree, Rashi says, davar kal shabo, the lightest thing on the tree. So the leaves are not the trunk or the twigs or the branches of law, of certainty. They are the leaves that get swayed in the wind, that flap around, that are malleable and pliant. And that represents poetry. And if we think about the cycle this creates, poetry justifies itself. The proof isn't a verse that says poetry is good. It's not a verse that says musings are good. It's a verse that says leaves don't wither. How on earth does that prove any point unless you treat that poetry with interpretation? So it's a very intelligent, very insightful way of saying that poetry justifies itself. Anyone who thinks it's unworthy of attention, go and read a poem. Who can't be struck by a powerful poem? So that's not directly related, but it comes up to our general endeavour and is from our psalm. So we turn the page, page 6, and now we deal with the last verses of this chapter. First verses we had Ashrei, which we dealt with, happiness. It had the three figures we dealt with. The Rasha of philosophy, the Chote of impulse, the Leitz of laziness, of cowardice. And then we turn to the second part of the psalm, which dealt with trees and metaphor of that nature. Now we turn to the end, the conclusion, which again in the verse said, the last verse, Ki Odea Hashem Derech Tzadikim. God knows the path of the righteous. What does that mean? He knows it. For derech v'sha'im toved, and the path of the wicked is lost. That's pretty straightforward, we would think. So let's look into the Malbim. He will tell us, what does it mean that God knows the righteous and the wicked will be lost? Hayidia hazot, top box, page 6. Hayidia hazot, he hidbat kut hamushkal b'mashkil. This yidia, this knowing, is the connection of an intellectual nature, of the understander and the understandee, the one who teaches, the teacher and the student. It is, in other words, a meeting of the minds. We're not just saying God knows this in the sense that I know it's sunny today, but in an intimate way, in the same way that we talk about Yodea in the biblical sense. You know them in the biblical sense. It means to be intimate, like Adam Yodea et Chava, Adam knew Chava. So God knows the path of the righteous. He has a meeting of the minds. Shehem yit bakuba hanitzchi habilti mishtaneh. The righteous attach themselves to enduring and everlasting things. V'nei derech tzadikim shedorchem, and now we have the metaphor a little bit, the path, the physical path they walk on, mahalech hashlemut bimsalahu ula beit el. It is an ascending ladder which goes up to the house of God. They walk on this steady ladder. Lahavayt Hashem uladavka bo, to love God and to cleave to Him. Hu bilti nifrad miyidiato, and without ever verging from that intimacy, from that compassion, care, and loving, nishar nitzchi kayem kamohu, they are left enduring, eternal. Valkeim, heim nisharim lenetzach, and therefore they last forever. It's okay, we're all popular, it's fine. So, we all get calls. So why is the righteous known by God? It means they are intimate together. God and the righteous person share a path. In some ways, if we want to take the metaphor a little further, we are connecting to the celestial spinal cord, to the nerve centers of heaven. And once we're connected to that eternal being, we can never die. We always have that life source. And this is a little mystical, a little Kabbalistic. It's a way of saying God knows the righteous. They never lose their impact. Ah, but, aval derech harasha'im, the path of the wicked, al imke sha'ol, goes to the depths of hell. El dvarim habluyim v'nifsadin, to the things which wear away and dissolve. Lo yit kashru b'yidit Hashem, they don't attach themselves to this intimacy with God. They don't have that inner sense of an awesome being. And therefore, in the end, inevitably, their path disintegrates as if they never were. No existence. So while the righteous have this spinal cord of God, the wicked weaves rope out of cord of iniquity. It frays all the time and eventually falls away, as summed up by T.S. Eliot in a poem, The Rock, which speaks to our earlier metaphor. Man without God is a seed upon the wind, driven this way and that, and finding no place of lodgment and germination. We just float as chaff in the wind. That is the wicked. No presence, no permanence, gone. So that's the end of the first psalm in one reading of the Maldim. How do we finish? David says, you will be happy if you avoid these people. And then we end by saying, why? Because these people die. Everyone dies, but in a spiritual sense. These people have nothing lasting. They float. They drift in the wind. Avoid them. That's one reading. And there's quite a conviction there that the wicked will die. That the wicked won't prosper. Which almost takes a stand on our question of why good things happen to bad people. They don't. That's the claim. Wicked have no path. So that's one claim, and that's comforting to the happy person who avoids this because, I'm going to be known by God. But now we move from comfort to consolation, a very different type. That picture in the middle of the page you see is a painting of Boethius. Has anybody heard of Boethius? A good friend of mine. No, he's not. That's a ridiculous name. Boethius lived in the 5th century. He was a Roman consul, the head of his game. He was the top. And then he was imprisoned by another king who decided he was a traitor, locked him up, and eventually executed him. Oh, bad luck. So he was confounded. Maybe by this song. Probably not. But maybe. I was the top of the game. I was the consul. I was even righteous. He was a good man. And I'm sitting in a cell. What happened to Derech Rasha'im Toved? What happened to the falling away, the perishing of wickedness? Why am I stuck here? And as he sat in that prison cell, ripped by grief, tormented by confusion, he wrote a book called The Consolation of Philosophy. And I'm going to read just a few lines at the beginning of this book to get a small taste for it. I'm sorry I didn't give it to you, it was just late that I thought of this. I was writing this in a silence broken only by the scratchings of my quill as I recorded these gloomy thoughts. When there was a presence of which, I gradually became aware looming over my head. The figure of a woman whose look filled me with awe. Her burning gaze was indescribably penetrating, unlike that of anyone I had ever met. And while her complexion was as fresh and glowing as that of a girl, I realized that she was an ancient, and that nobody would mistake her for a creature of our time. It was impossible to estimate her height, for she seemed at first to be of ordinary measure, but then, without seeming to change, she appeared to be extraordinarily tall, so that her head almost touched the heavens. I was certain that if she had the mind to stretch her neck just a little, her face would penetrate the skies, where it would be utterly lost to human view. Her dress was a miracle of fine cloth and meticulous workmanship, and as I later learned, she had woven it herself. But it had darkened like a smoke-blackened family statue in the atrium, as if through neglect, and was dingy and worn. And this woman, who is both tall and short, old and new, who wears a dress of miraculous fabric that has worn with time, is philosophy. And as he sits in his cell, he realizes how to console himself with all the power he needs in his mind. And there's a different reading of our psalm, because we may be confronted by similar confusion in life. We may find ourselves struck by misfortune, which philosophy explains to Boethius, as in that picture, fortune. We may have heard of the TV program, The Wheel of Fortune, but that comes from Boethius and the philosophy. Look at that image. On top of the wheel is the king, on the bottom is the pauper, and it could turn at any moment. And there he finds consolation, because he didn't do something wrong. That's just the way the world works. And that's how we could explain our psalm. Not that the wicked will perish, but we have to read it somehow differently. And this is done by Chazal in our final source. Amar Rav Barachya. Rav Barachya says in our final midrash, "B'sha'a shabah HaKadosh Baruch Hu libara'ot Adam harishon." When God came to the moment of creation, I'm going to make mankind. He suddenly, in that image, it is as if he saw Ra'at Sadikim v'Rasha'im Omdim Imenu. He sees Adam's descendants. Some good, some righteous, some bad. Amar, and he said to himself, Im avarenu rasha'im omdim imenu. Oi, I'm caught in a quandary. If I create this man, there will be wickedness. Wicked people will exist. Lo avirenu, but if I don't create him, tzadikim hech omdim imenu. How will the righteous exist? What can I do? It's either all or nothing. Ma'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what did God do? He did a cost-benefit analysis. Hiflig darkan shel rasha'im mekeneged panav. He neglected to look. He closed one eye and didn't look at what the rasha'im are going to do. He ignored that. V'shitef bo midat rachamim. And he engaged with mercy. V'ara'o. And he created man. How do we know? From our psalm. Ki yodeh Hashem derech tzadikim, because God knows the ways of the righteous, v'derech v'sha'im toved, and the ways of wickedness will perish. What does that mean? Mahu toved, what does it mean, perish? Ibdam mikeneged panav, it means he abandoned it from before his face. He ignored it. Not that it will perish in some eschatological sense, they will die. But at the beginning, in creation, God ignored evil. He knows wicked exists. He knows we can get struck by misfortune. But you shouldn't have grief. You should be consoled. That's just the way it works. And what we have to do is strive to be that tzaddik. To be always ashrei, progressing and striding towards that happiness and righteousness. So those are two ways of reading the end of the psalm. Either confidence, we're going to do fine, we're happy. Or less confident in fortune, but more confident inside, consoled by philosophy. God knows there's evil. That doesn't mean I did anything wrong. It's just the way it works. And I have to make my strides towards happiness. Next week we do Psalm 2. Have a wonderful day.